Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and man, am I happy to be here today. Anyway, we have a really, really great show for you today, and I'm going to be real quick moving into it. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth, author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. And before that, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about the so-called end of the war in Iraq. But before we do all that, we're going to be talking about the Occupy Wall Street movement that's spread all over the country since early October. Now, this movement has been both inspiring to many millions of people and very brave as the authorities have viciously attacked it in Oakland, California, and many other cities, most recently smashing the original encampment in Zuccotti Park in New York City and driving the occupiers out. During the same period, Oakland was hit again, and a number of other Occupy sites around the country have been attacked by the police. The occupiers have not backed down. They are declaring they will not turn around and walk away, and they're calling on people everywhere to stand with them. And just the other day, I had the opportunity to talk with Raymond Latta about the Occupy movement. Raymond's a communist political economist and writer for Revolution, and we spoke about what's the importance of the Occupy movement and what are the questions, some of the questions that are posed up in there. So without any further delay, let's get into and listen to that interview with Raymond Latta. I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Raymond Latta. Now, for listeners of the show, you know Raymond. He's a political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he bases his work on and promotes the new synthesis of communism of Babavakian. And Raymond gave a talk at Occupy Wall Street in New York City a little while back titled, Are Corporations Corrupting the System, or Is the Problem the System of Capitalism? Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Michael. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Sure, man. Well, let's jump into this so we can make the most of our time here. What is it that makes Occupy Wall Street in New York and all across the country, the entire movement that sprung up around it, so important today?
I've been down there quite a bit, and the talk that you mentioned at the outset is a talk that I've given several times, and it's very exciting, the atmosphere. Well, look, I think when we step back, what we're seeing is that tens of thousands have stood up and been defiant, have been determined, have been courageous, and really shining a spotlight on the economic and social injustices and inequalities in this society and in the world. And people have really braved police attacks in Denver and Oakland. It's been really rather remarkable how this has developed, and it has, in its development, aroused, inspired, and emboldened growing numbers of people, and it's shattered a lot of the passivity that great numbers of people were sort of into and experiencing, and this is sort of setting a new standard for people in terms of standing up. And at the same time, the audacity and the ways in which people have been coming together in these encampments. You know, I've been spending a lot of time in the encampment here in New York and Wall Street, but in other parts of the country, you know, people are forging and experimenting with new forms of community. And this is another aspect. I mean, people are standing up defiantly, but they're also challenging the mind-numbing atomization of this society where everybody feels isolated and left to their own. And now people are sensing, you know, that there's some possibility that didn't exist before. And this is very, very important. And here in New York, and I also know in Los Angeles, Michael, that people at the Occupy encampments have also been connecting with other struggles outside of the immediate encampments and outside of what people immediately came together around. For instance, around police repression, and here in New York, there were demonstrations that were joined by people from Occupy Wall Street in opposition to the stop and frisk of Black and Latino youth. Same thing happened out there in Los Angeles on October 22nd, where people are linking up with the bitter experiences and the oppression of other sections of people. This is very significant. A new generation of young people have stepped forward, and it's a major development in U.S. society, and it's really changing the conversation and opening up a whole debate about, you know, the way the world is and how might it be different and how could we change things. And this is an extraordinary development that needs to be built upon and learned from. And at the same time, as I said, there are big debates about where will this go, what is the direction, and what is the fundamental solution to the problems we're facing? Indeed, what is the problem?
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that actually really strikes me is that what people talk about is the ruthless inhumanity of capitalism in one way or another. And it's really refreshing to see this. To me, it's something that really has struck a chord among people and moved people to stand up and say, not only is the world intolerable, but we're going to do something about it. And that's one of the things I was really, really moved by in this whole thing.
Yeah, and it has spread. It's become a magnet. You know, there was a first encampment here in Wall Street, and certain, you know, mainly young people were involved, and then broader and broader sections of people, you know, have hooked up with this, of coming out, you know, bringing food, you know, bringing entertainment, being part of the whole cultural scene. You know, it's really quite remarkable and very, very important, because it is that combination of resistance and people having big debates and big conversations about the way the world is.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Lotta, political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the Occupy Wall Street movement, and in particular, we've been talking about the importance of that movement. I want to move in now, Raymond, to talking about some of the questions that you found that are posed by a lot of the wrangling that's going on down there, and one of them you alluded to already. Probably one of the most common themes is the corporations are the problem. And the idea that the entire society is ruled by and in service to corporations. There's the idea, in addition to that, that if you bring these corporations under control or bust them up, then we would be able to solve the problems associated with these corporations. What do you say to that?
That has been a very sharp issue, and one that I've been addressing and really trying to get to the taproot of what the problem is. Now, many people do see that the problem is corporations as being too big and too powerful. And there's a view of corporations as these autonomous, you know, entities that are kind of calling the shots on their own. But what I've been arguing for and helping people to see and trying to bring an understanding about is that it's not that the corporations are too big or too powerful, but that the corporations are actually part of something bigger. In other words, it doesn't begin and end with these corporations, that the banks and the corporations actually embody the economic relations of the system that we live under. That system is capitalism. And that's the way we have to be looking at this. For instance, corporations come and go. These corporations exist for a few decades or more, and then they merge. J.P. Morgan merged with Chase. Texaco was sort of swallowed up by Chevron. Some corporations, some banks go bankrupt, like the Lehman Brothers. And this is an expression of the fact that these corporations actually answer to and reflect the underlying nature, the underlying laws of this economic system. And this is one of the points that I've been trying to bring out in my talks. Just what do these corporations embody? What are their relations? And how do we understand these corporations functioning in the way that they do and how they operate, what their organizational forms are, what those organizational forms express, and what they serve? And what I've been emphasizing is that actually, if you take a large transnational corporation or a bank like a Toyota or an ExxonMobil, these corporations are actually units for the production and the accumulation of profit, whether we're talking about assembling cars, whether we're talking about drilling for oil in the Arctic. These corporations are units for the production and accumulation of profit. Second, they are instruments for the organized exploitation of labor. That's what happens within the corporate framework. That's what this instrument serves. If you take the iPad, the iPhone from Apple, well, you know, Apple headquarters is sort of command control for a very elaborate supply chain that involves other corporations and outsourcing. And these corporations, as I said, are instruments for the organized exploitation of labor, viciously super exploiting Chinese workers in Guangdong province. That's where the iPad and the iPhone come from. And third, these corporations are instruments of ownership and control by a capitalist class, by the dominant class in the society, which is politically calling the shots in this society. So these corporations, the metaphor that I like to use about this is that they are actually pieces on a global chessboard. That's what these corporations are. And they consolidate, they merge, they go under, but they are pieces, not the only pieces, but critical pieces on a global chessboard that operates according to certain rules.
We're talking with communist political economist Raymond Lotta. And Raymond, we're talking about the Occupy movement and some of the questions posed up. And we're talking now just about the corporations and the focus on corporations and how to look at all this. And one of the things you just said, I think, is extremely important, that these corporations function according to certain rules. And in brief, can you talk about what those rules are? Because it's not like, you know, there used to be this idea that if you break up the monopolies, then suddenly these things will not be able to function anymore. They'll have to, we can make them, if we put enough restrictions on them, we can make them somehow be less savage and barbarous, you know, and you actually argued that these corporations follow certain rules and they don't have any choice but to follow these rules.
Yeah, right. This is what I'm saying, that they obey a certain logic, and that logic is the logic of capitalism. That's why I'm saying we have to see the difference and the interrelationship between an organizational form, you know, a large transnational bank or corporation, that organizational form, you know, with its board of directors, with its line of command, and its internal organization. We have to recognize the relationship between these huge mega entities and the underlying laws of capitalism, the underlying sort of ways in which these corporations must behave if they are going to be survivors and winners on this global playing field that I'm talking about. So I sort of talk about the example, if you're playing basketball and you kick the ball down court as though you were playing soccer, well, that's not how that game is played. And capitalism, which is not a game entertainment-wise, it's not a game, it's a killing, suffering, horrifying system, but it operates according to certain rules, a logic that is the logic that has to be adhered to by these corporations, as I said, if they're going to remain in this game. And what are those rules? Basically, there are three of them. One is that everything that's produced in this system, in this society, and it is a global system of exploitation, global capitalist system that we're talking about, everything that's produced is produced as a commodity that is for sale on the market. A commodity has to have some useful qualities, but it's fundamentally produced for sale, and everything is produced for profit, whether we're talking about housing, energy, transport, medicine. I mean, they don't talk about medicine, they talk about the healthcare industry, whether we're talking about communications, computers, everything that's produced, how it's produced, where it's produced, and whether it does get produced is governed by profitability. That's what is the first rule of this game, that everything is produced as a commodity that is for the market and for profit. And that is what sort of drives things in terms of the evaluation, the criteria. Is it needed? Is an electric car needed? Well, that's not the point. What's the point is whether it's profitable. Will they be drilling for oil in the Arctic, or will they be developing, you know, an alternative form of energy? Well, that is governed by profitability criteria. So that's the first rule of the game. The second is that you have these huge units of capital that we're talking about, you know, whether, you know, General Motors as it's been reconstructed or the oil industry, you have these huge units of capital and they're privately owned. They're privately owned and they're competing with each other in their own sphere and outside of those spheres. They're competing with each other and they're driven forward by a commandment. Marx actually in Capital talks about this as a commandment, and it's the commandment to expand or die. They have to constantly expand. They have to grow at a compound rate. They have to find the cheapest way to produce things in order to secure and get a hold on and to expand their market share. And if they don't do that, if they want to be benign, if they want to go to sleep, well, they're going to go under. They're going to lose out. They're going to be gobbled up. It's beat or be beaten. And that applies to whether we're talking about high-tech industry, whether we're talking to manufacturing corporations, banks. They have to expand. They have to expand their sphere of operations. They have to beat their rivals. And we're seeing, even last week, this MF Global, a financial firm, went under because it was betting on these European sovereign debt. And other banking, other financial entities were moving to take advantage of this situation, and they couldn't hold their own. They went under. And all of this is fundamentally grounded in the exploitation of wage labor on a world scale. I mean, the banks are not directly exploiting workers in factories, but they're connected through elaborate financial transactions and ownership patterns. They are all bound up with this whole system of world exploitation. And the third rule of the game is that there is a struggle for global control and dominance. You know, I talked about this competition that takes place, but this global chessboard is a global chessboard, and corporations and banks are competing for influence and for control, whether it's the auto market in China, whether it's oil and natural gas supplies in the Caspian Sea. And the most intense and acute form of competition is the rivalry between the great imperial states and the great powers, rivalry for control over regions, rivalry to secure, you know, the U.S. now has established several years ago a new military force command because it's concerned about oil supplies off the west coast of Africa. So there is this struggle for global dominance. These are the three rules of the game: profit, the drive to expand or die, and this struggle for global control. And that's what sort of underlies the behavior of these corporations. And they can break them up, as they did, let's take AT&T and Bell way back. That was broken up. And then it reemerged in new forms. and new communications, telecommunications companies emerge, and you have the same basic picture of these huge monopolistic global firms that are competing for that kind of control and market share.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Lada, communist political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper. We're talking about the Occupy movement and the questions that get concentrated up in a lot of it for a lot of people. Now, Raymond, one of the things that I think is really imperative to talk about, you know, in a way, because it gets jumbled up with this whole question of corporations, how to handle them, should they be restricted, what role can the state play in monitoring them and restricting them, and it also ties in with, I think, the whole way that people see changing things or the relations that exist in society as well, which is gets into the 99% and the 1% equation that people raise, which has a really good aspect to it, but also has something that's, it doesn't quite fit the picture, I think. So can you talk about the role of state power in capitalism? Because it's not really this kind of neutral thing that people can influence one way or the other, but it actually has a very intense role in capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of times when I'm giving my talks or lectures, people will say, well, what you're describing, these rules of the game, or when we talk about the role of the government, they're saying, well, you're not really talking about a pure capitalism. You're not really talking about a market capitalism, an unfettered market capitalism. Well, there has never been a capitalism that has existed outside the framework of a state, power, national governments. And, as capitalism developed into a global system, these governments and this state power is operating from the standpoint of defending and safeguarding the interest of a capitalist owning class on a world scale. So there's no separation of a market economy, of a developed capitalist economy from a state, from a state power. And what does the government, which is a critical part of the state power, the key instrumentality of a state, is the military force, is the armed force of oppression. Now, what does this capitalist class need a state for? Because, as I said, you have this economically dominant class, the capitalist class, which owns and controls the major means of production, land, resources, the raw materials, control over technology, intellectual property rights. Because this class monopolizes control over the means of production, then you have another class, the vast majority of wage laborers, who must sell their capacity to work in order to survive. Now, this class dominates and controls economic life, but the government, the state power, which it also controls, is essential to its existence, because this state power, this government, executive branch and the bureaucracy at the highest levels, and as I said, the military, what is it doing? It's acting to protect and to expand this economic system of capitalism. And the state, the government, is acting to keep this whole society functioning as a capitalist society. And the state is not answering to this or that corporation, on the level of being bought off, so on and so forth. This state plays certain functions which are defined by the maintenance of the rule of this capitalist class and the preservation and extension of its long-term and strategic interest. In other words, what the state is doing is concentrating up the strategic interests of the capitalist class, and it operates through several different means and mechanisms. As I said, the key thing is that the state, the capitalist class, as it controls the state, has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. We're talking about the army, the police, the courts, the prison system. All of this is to maintain the rule of this capitalist class. And we've seen the whole history of progressive movements in this society coming under attack, the attacks on Occupy Wall Street itself in Denver and Oakland, vicious repression. And then we have the whole phenomenon of stop and frisk of Black and Latino youth, which is an attempt to politically control a potentially rebellious section of society, to warehouse them into the prison. So there is the use of force. Second, there are economic functions that the state serves, which again concentrate up the highest strategic interests of capitalism, whether we're talking about taxes and spending to build infrastructure, ports and harbors and the transport system, or the banking, the central banking system, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, which is like the financial nervous system of capitalism in its modern development. And then there's the regulation of the activities of corporations and banks, the laws and the rules, which again provide a certain framework through which profit is produced and profit is accumulated. And then you have the role of the state in negotiating treaties like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, all of which is serving the creation of more favorable conditions for the accumulation of capital. And then, as we talk about that on a world scale, we have this state which is safeguarding the interest of a global empire. You know, the U.S. economy is not a self-contained thing. It's really, I like to describe it as the home base of a worldwide network of exploitation. And here you have the state, the U.S. government, which has established over 700 military bases in over 100 countries. This, again, is serving the political and economic needs of empire. And then finally, this state plays a vital role ideologically in legitimizing the system and making people think that it is serving their larger interest and that it is acting at their behest. It is responding to their accountability. This is part of the great game ideologically that's played by the system and gets concentrated up in elections. Sort of, it's commonly thought that the electoral system, voting, is basically a good thing as it exists in the society, but that in recent years, moneyed interests, the corporations through Supreme Court rulings have somehow polluted or sullied or tainted a basically good voting system. But in fact, you know, this voting system is not something that's just used by this or that corporation throwing their money around to get their way, although they do throw their money around. There's a deeper purpose behind elections, and we're told that we control the system through the elections. But in point of fact, the system controls us through elections. That's how this is all designed. The policies, the agendas, the candidates, the whole way in which this operates is to legitimize the rule and the agendas, as I said, of the ruling class and their different wings as they themselves will fight for a certain strategic perspective. And we, as voters, are told that we are somehow setting the terms and forcing them to respond to our needs and to our vote. But in fact, the voting is designed, as I said, to demobilize and to atomize people. It is part of the system of control.
Well, tell me this, Raymond. How does this relate to, in fact, the question that's posed of a lot of people? I mean, the very common sentiment down there that I think, again, is something that I think you've spoken to before, but the idea of 99% versus 1%, that we are the 99% and we stand diametrically opposed to the 1%. In terms of a way of viewing society and viewing all the stuff that you're talking about, the way to change society and the role of the state.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we are the 99%, you know, they are the 1%. I mean, this is really getting at something that is very real. That is, it's speaking to the grossly unequal distribution of wealth and income in U.S. society. In other words, everything we've been discussing, Michael, you know, the functioning of this system leads to these extraordinary inequalities, these extraordinary gaps in terms of income and wealth. And these are things that flow out of the very workings of the system. But what I like to point out to people is that if your picture of the society and of the system is that of the pie, you know, the proverbial pie that's sliced up in different ways, if you look at the system simply as a net amount of wealth, and then it gets distributed in different ways according to who has the upper hand here or there or the outcome of an election. This is a very wrong and erroneous view of how the system operates and what it's basically founded upon. In other words, this picture of the pie that's sliced up in different ways, it is true that wealth is extremely polarized in its distribution. But the fundamental question, the decisive question, is ownership and control. That is, a small capitalist class owns and controls the means of producing wealth. Just six financial institutions control over 50% of the financial assets that is within the United States. You have these large oil companies that dominate the energy market. You have these huge corporations and banks, as we've said, that as we get back to my earlier points about what these banks and these corporations are actually the organized expressions of, are the expression of the fact that you have this small capitalist class that owns and controls the means of production. And because of that, you have the situation where people must sell their labor power in order to survive to that class which does control these means of production, and the whole system is organized around production. So what we're talking about is not just the distribution of wealth, but more fundamentally, the control over the means of producing wealth, wealth that is produced socially through the interconnected efforts of thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. Take that iPhone. That is the result of the interconnected efforts of people producing something and subjected to savage exploitation. And then everything that people do, their creativity, the whole division of labor in society, the way in which people interact with each other, also reflects the nature of this system, the fact that it's governed by profit. So our creativity is stunted and stilted and subordinated to the needs and imperatives of profit. Everything, we have to compete for jobs, for houses, for entrance into school, compete even in the marketplace of human relationships. That's all part of the way in which this system stamps everything. So the question of the we are the 99%, they are the 1%, does speak to something very real about the distribution of wealth. But that 1%, if we want to use that as a metaphor for the capitalist class, is not just this amorphous grouping of fantastically rich, parasitic, and corrupt bankers and investors, what have you. This is an actual capitalist class that has a grip on state power, and that because it has a grip on the government, the military, and other repressive forces, it is controlling and commanding how society actually works. And this is something that, you know, I'm really trying to bring forward to people, that if we are going to sort of understand the nature of the system, we have to look at those underlying laws that I talked about, and then we have to look at the system not just as one of how wealth is divided up in a pie, but the whole system of ownership and control, and how that people also are relating to each other in a division of labor, in the way in which labor and our work is routinized and controlled, and how we're alienated. All of this flows from the nature of this system, that is those laws and the whole system of ownership.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much. We've just run up on our time, so I'm going to ask you real quick if you have something in less than a minute that you want to say to cap this off, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, too.
Yeah, well, I just want to thank you for having me on. There's so much to talk about, and this is itself, I think, an expression of the kind of opportunity, the kind of opening, the kind of conversation that is now taking place on a grand scale, and that we need to bring forward. I, you know, I'm speaking as someone who promotes the perspectives of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and as I said, popularizing the new synthesis of communism of Bob Avakian. We need to get into these big discussions about why the system is the way it is and what it's going to take to actually bring a new, a radically different and better world into being. And here I want to encourage people to read Revolution newspaper and to check out the writings of Bob Avakian. And all of this can be found at revcom.us. And Avakian has this remarkable piece that just went up, and people can get it at revcom.us, about this whole controversy about leaderless struggles, leaderless movements, leaderless revolutions. And he talks about the kind of leadership, the kind of organization that we need to be talking about if we are going to really confront the problem, the enormity of the problem, and actually bring a liberating, emancipatory world into being.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much, and we'll have you on again real soon.
Cool.
All right, take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right, welcome back. And that was Raymond Lada. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, journalist from Revolution Newspaper, about the supposed end of the war in Iraq. So stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Larry Everest. Larry is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Now, on October 21st, Obama announced that all 40,000 remaining U.S. military forces were going to be withdrawn from Iraq. By the end of this year, he made it clear it's going to be the end of this year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq is going to be over. Now, that's what he said. And he presented this as the fulfillment of a campaign promise, a proud moment for the U.S. in fulfilling a noble mission, a transitional period, and something that was ending in a position of strength and opening up a new day where the tide of war is receding. What the hell do you make of this?
Well, wrong on all counts. Number one, yes, the U.S. was forced to withdraw its troops at the end of this year, 40,000. But number one, that doesn't mean that the U.S. is not going to have a presence in Iraq, is not going to try to continue to shape events in that country, much less leave the region. It's also a time Obama talked about people needing to reflect on the war. I agree. Let's reflect on what this war was really all about. And let's look at whether the U.S. is really leaving Iraq from a position of strength or not.
Well, now, you make the point in your article that in order to really understand what's going on and why, you need to consider all this, how the war started and why it started and what's been revealed in the course of it. So let's get into that a little.
Well, I mean, it was Obama talked about this as if it was a noble mission and the U.S. had accomplished great things and so on. But as you say, Michael, let's remember this was a war launched in March of 2003 on the basis of bald-faced lies that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that it was tied to Al-Qaeda and somehow linked to September 11th. These were lies. The U.S. government has sort of tried to wash this away by claiming, well, we made some mistakes in intelligence and so on and so forth. But that, too, is part of a cover-up. These were bald-faced lies. The U.S. knew full well Iraq was not a grave and gathering threat, that if it had any weapons of mass destruction, they were very, very minor amounts. It knew full well that Iraq was not involved with Al-Qaeda or September 11th. In fact, they were hostile to these Islamic fundamentalists. So these were deliberate lies that were cooked up. And that's one thing. And the other thing, the basic nature of this war, and we should get into the agenda that this war was fought for, but the basic nature of this war was an act of violent aggression by the world's dominant military power, a country that's the only country to drop the atomic bomb twice, and it's invaded more countries than anybody else on the face of the earth. It was a violent attack on a small third world country that posed no direct threat to the U.S. This was a war crime. It was the classic definition of a war of aggression, much like what the Nazis were tried for at Nuremberg.
Before we get into this Hitlerian character of all this, let's talk about this a little bit. You talked about the lies that they manufactured to carry this out, but there was a real driving force behind this. It wasn't just sort of the evil nature of the evil empire. They actually had a driving need to launch and fight this war. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, that's really important, right? That's really important to point to, because this wasn't simply about Bush and Cheney being cowboys or even oil men, you know, that it was simply about the oil industry. The invasion of Iraq grew out of really the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And the radical change that this gave rise to on the whole global playing field. In a nutshell, over that decade, the 90s and leading into the Bush regime brought to power in 2001, there was a big debate in the ruling class over how do we seize this unipolar moment, this moment when the U.S. was the only superpower on Earth, at the same time with the collapse of the then Soviet Union and other imperialist rivals. At the same time, the rulers felt that their grip and their opportunities could be slipping away, that they were being faced with new challenges, in particular in the Middle East, which is a region with 60% of the world's energy reserves, a key geostrategic crossroads, and a pillar of U.S. domination since World War II. So a group emerged that felt that the thing to do that must be done was to seize on these attacks of September 11th to launch a decades-long war to impose by violence U.S. much more direct control, direct dominance in the Middle East, reshape this region, get much more direct control of energy sources as well as access to market and military bases and so on, and in turn use this and conceiving of this as part of a much bigger global strategy to become an unchallenged and unchallenged empire. I felt Bob Avakian really summed it up best. Shortly after September 11th, he wrote these imperialists want to reshuffle the whole deck, reorder the whole situation. That really captured and their whole strategic outlook, and was one of the things that convinced me that by shortly after September 11th, 2001, that they were in fact going to wage war on Iraq.
We're talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the supposed end of the war in Iraq. Now, Larry, you made reference earlier to the Hitlerian character of things, and on one level, we've talked often about the character of the invasion itself, the fact that they invaded a country without any justification at all, and how that violates all kinds of international law. But you also bring another aspect of the Hitlerian character in the article that you've just recently written in Revolution Newspaper. You talk about the terrible, terrible impact of the war on the Iraqi people. People cannot be allowed to forget what that was.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, in his speech, Obama made passing reference. First, he said, "Our many wounded warriors and nearly 4,500 American patriots," and then sort of as an aside, "and their Iraqi and coalition partners who gave their lives to this effort." It's like a throwaway reference to the Iraqi people who suffered horribly. There are different estimates of the number of people who have died in Iraq as a result of the war, whether directly being killed or dying from disease and starvation or trauma from this whole experience, being wounded and not having hospital care. That number is between 650,000 and 1 million, according to a couple of different studies. We also have 4.7 million Iraqis who were driven from their home. That's the equivalent of like 40, 50, 60 million people in the United States being forced into refuge as people were in Hurricane Katrina. It's an enormous toll. 2 million of those have been driven from Iraq entirely. 3 million women are widowed as a result of this war, many having been forced into prostitution. So that's just a glimpse of some of the things this U.S. war has inflicted on people. There's been horrible sectarian warfare against the Sunnis in particular. There's been torture at Abu Ghraib and other prisons, and these horrible massacres, for instance, Haditha, that are barely mentioned in the U.S. press. It's just the most ugly chauvinism, only American lives count for anything, that's being recited here. This is what came to my mind as I was writing the article and thinking over both the motivation and the results of this war. These imperialists make the Godfather look like Mary Poppins. That's really who we're dealing with here.
All right, well, we've talked about the character of the war. Let's talk a little bit about the withdrawal of U.S. forces, because this is actually what's up on the table right now for debate. What do you think? Mission accomplished, or are they forced into a place they didn't necessarily want to occupy? Because it seems to me, when you look at whatever they're doing, there's a whole lot of contradictions in the mix here.
Well, you're right. I mean, this was not Plan A. This was not even Plan B. I mean, to begin with the withdrawal, up until this past summer, a few months ago, the U.S. was trying to desperately to try to maintain a troop presence of up to 20,000 troops in Iraq. In 2008, George Bush had signed an agreement for the withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Iraq by December this year, 2011. But the expectation, they may have even had verbal agreements, was that the U.S. would leave some kind of a residual force there because they want Iraq, A, as a platform in the region, B, they're very concerned about instability in Iraq. Iraq remains a smoldering powder keg. C, there's a potential for other countries to intervene in Iraq, and most importantly, they're worried about Iranian influence in Iraq. So this was the reason they actually wanted to have these troops. And the negotiations fell apart because the U.S. insisted on immunity for its soldiers, which tells you something right there about what its soldiers are doing in Iraq. But it's also a product of the fact that the Iraqi government is riven by different factions and divisions. There's a certain degree of instability there. They were also concerned too close an embrace to the United States could lead to an Arab Spring, an uprising of the people in Iraq itself. So these were some of the reasons that the U.S. was forced into an agreement that they really did not want. Now, they are going to retain about 10,000 contractors and other personnel in Iraq. They are also building up their military forces. Right now, there are 40,000 U.S. forces in the region, 23,000 of them in Kuwait, in the region, not counting Afghanistan or Iraq. So there's still a big presence there. But nonetheless, this was not a move that the U.S. wanted to make. And then, as you mentioned, much deeper contradictions that they're dealing with as well.
We're talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about the supposed end of the war in Iraq. Now, Larry, one thing that figures very largely, and you got to be completely blind and deaf to not see this on the horizon here, the idea of Iran and what's developing with Iran. That seems to be one of the major strategic complexities that they're facing right now.
Well, there's enormous strategic complexity involving Iran and really the whole region. Let's not forget, going back to the beginning, that Bush, Cheney, and the rest of the U.S. imperialist ruling class dreamed of reshaping the entire Middle East and making it, quote-unquote, friendly to U.S. interests, strengthening Israel, having wide open access to this whole region. But what's happened over these 8 years instead has been that, number one, the U.S. invasion has fueled hatred of the United States. It's fueled reactionary Islamic fundamentalism, which is one of the obstacles they were trying to overcome. It's provided openings for rivals globally. It's also strengthened Iran, which was actually a primary target of the U.S. going in. I mean, and look, in April or May of 2003, they were joking with the viceroy of Iraq, Jay Garner, hey, do you want to go to Tehran next? That's the kind of hubris and grand ambitions that was circulating in Washington at the time. And very quickly, this ran up on the rocks of this cauldron of contradiction in the Middle East. So right now, the U.S. has not been able to accomplish everything it's wanted to in Iraq or in the region. Its military is stretched extremely thin. It's facing new challenges, even as Obama is trying to regroup and more efficiently maintain U.S. domination. And the primary challenge focuses around Iran. And we're hearing a lot of talk these days about a possible Israeli attack on Iran. There is a new IAEA report coming out and reportedly accusing Iran of working toward nuclear weapons. We don't know the validity of that. It's questionable. But there's a whole complex of strategic imperatives, if you will, driving the U.S. toward a collision with Iran. And this is very, very serious. And I think it points back to one of your earlier questions. This is driven by the necessity of the capitalist imperialist system. This isn't just a bunch of cowboys or misunderstanding or whatever. U.S. imperialism is compelled to try to control and dominate the world, to have control over strategic resources, strategic regions, and markets, and to do so with violence and military force. This is the nature of imperialism.
All right, Larry, thank you very much. Our time has run out, and we're going to have you back again real soon. We'll be following these developments in the region, as we always have. And it's always, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, bro.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
All right, we've been talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and you can get his latest article on the situation in Iraq and the supposed end of the war in Iraq in the latest issue of Revolution, and you can access that at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth, the author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. So stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show my next guest. He's a man who's known in some parts of the country and to some people as Dwayne Booth. In other parts of the country, he's known as the Great and Mighty Oz. And in still other parts of the country, he's known as Mr. Fish. Dwayne, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Sure. Well, you know, I've been fixated on your book, and I've been looking at your book ever since. We had Dwayne on the show and his book, Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People.
Right.
Okay. And
right.
You're going to really try your damnedest to do that today, right?
Yeah.
There you go. All right. Well, welcome back. And so much has happened in the world since we last met.
Yeah, it's different.
And a lot has happened to you. What's happening?
To the world or me?
To you. We'll get into the world after that.
I've been touring around with the book and having a really great time. Lots of people have been coming out to hear me complain, which I was not expecting. You know, I mean, you know the book, that it's pretty intense and it's pretty accusatory of everybody except me. Maybe. But really, I mean, I was down south just a couple, maybe a month ago. I was in Georgia, and I had gotten this gig through the Decatur Book Festival. And the person who was putting it together, she got my book and read it on an airplane and got off the airplane and contacted my publisher and said, I need to have Mr. Fish. This is the most interesting book I've read all year, which is a danger, I think, because when I'm on an airplane, I don't know if it's the oxygen or the atmosphere or something, but I saw Spider-Man 3 on an airplane. I thought it was Shakespeare. So that was my fear, that she was experiencing my book with that same, you know. But I went down, and this is the South. And she was so enthusiastic about having me there, she gave me the main ballroom. There were chandeliers in the room that I was in. And there were a few hundred people that showed up, and they were all these, you know, most of them were probably over 60, and I killed.
That's great. Did you get caught? Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Dwayne Booth, a.k.a. Mr. Fish. Here's a question for you, because I think it's great because it indicates that something is changing. You know, and we've seen this since the beginning of October. And there's a wind of resistance that's blowing across the country. There's a lot going on. It's very exciting that wasn't going on when you and I last spoke.
Right.
And you've actually, what do you think about that? And you've actually been taking part in this, right?
Yeah, it's exciting because last time I was on the show, one of my biggest complaints was how easy it was for people to think that they were being politically active by staying at home and engaging with progressive websites or just watching The Daily Show. That was their level of commitment. And since then, people have obviously, you know, with the Occupy movement, are out on the streets. And it surprised a lot of people. And I was one of the people that it surprised.
So are you – now, I just want to get straight on this. Are you – getting consumed by these feelings of like awesome power, because when you complained about people feeling they were politically active by staying home, and suddenly they're all out.
Right, yeah.
Did you have something to do with that?
They needed just some cartoons, right? They needed a hero, and that's what I know. No, it's interesting too, because one thing about the movement that while I'm very excited about people sort of congregating around their own pain and their own rage, that to me is a real important thing to have in a movement. And it's interesting that the mainstream media and lots of people are demanding that they have some direction, you know, that they really need to say exactly what they expect from this. And I don't. I think that, like I said, to congregate around your own sense of sorrow and your own suffering is a very strong place to be. And I think that, in fact, if they started to bow to the demands for sort of setting an agenda for themselves, I think that that is a really dangerous thing to do. Because what you have, essentially, is a group of people who, to me, they're starved. They're starved for a real democracy, and they're starved for truth and justice. So if you are going to force them into writing down what their demands are. So if you're essentially asking a bunch of starving people, a huge amount of starving people, to agree on a menu, which is impossible. And that's what could unravel the momentum of this thing.
You know, it's interesting too, though, because one of the things I think that's really been, to me, really been very important about this movement, and it's something that flies in the face of everything that we've experienced in the last, since the 60s, really. You know, this whole idea of, and I think this is one of the reasons why the media keeps pumping this thing. What's your agenda? What are your demands?
Right.
You know, but there's actually one of the things this movement did was it really lifted off this terrible weight of this world is the best we can do. This is all that's possible. We might as well just burrow down and live with it.
Right. Right. And that's the one thing I respect the people who speak for the movement when they just refuse to answer that question. And I worry about the people who answer that question by saying, we're looking for just a fair form of capitalism. We're looking for a moral capitalism. And to me, that's another thing that is that spooks me and scares me, because I don't think there's such a thing. I don't think that you can ask for that and have a society sustain without tons of poor people still. It doesn't work. Morality cannot be inside of capitalism. And again, speaking, just getting back to the 60s thing, which we talked about when we were last doing this, it's true. One of the things that made that movement strong was the sensibilities. People were involved because they were inspired through literature and art and a way of being. There was this much more spiritual sort of like idea that they had about what life should be. And it wasn't arguing from just like, you know, we should just be better liberal Democrats. That just didn't happen. So what you have when you have people who argue for a cause and exclude all the political rhetoric and sort of that logic, that's when it makes sense. If you have people that assume politics is how you organize people and allow them to live and stuff, that's dangerous. Here's a question. Here's a question that I've just started asking this week. There's an election coming up, 2012. We keep hearing, it's just like, it's going to be an important election, which we hear every single time, because we're going to select somebody who's going to be the most powerful person on the planet. All right, now just think about that. Everybody accepts that. Take one step back and ask yourself, just think of in your personal life, think of somebody who you think is the smartest, kindest, fairest person. Would you even want that person to have the job of being the most powerful person on the planet? You wouldn't. You wouldn't do it. Yet, people accept that that's what we're doing, and people even get excited and throw confetti, wear paper hats over the whole thing, and they're basing this choice on somebody that is a stranger, as somebody who is a complete stranger, and they're just accepting the projection from this, you know, a multi-billion-dollar ad campaign that will get this person into office. And then the cycle repeats itself, and then as we get into the presidency, whoever it is, people react the same way. It's just like, well, wait a minute, you know, this toothpaste that I bought, it's not getting me all the girls that it said that it was going to get me, you know? And then the cycle repeats itself, and it's just, it absolutely puzzles me every time it comes around.
So toothpaste doesn't get you girls, huh?
You heard it here first, right?
Okay.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Dwayne Booth, a.k.a. Mr. Fish, the author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. And we're talking about the Occupy movement.
Actually, I think this is an important question to pursue a little, because, you know, one of the things is that I think this is one of the things, and it's obviously still a focus for a lot of debate within the Occupy movement. There is this point of voting. Actually, by the time you get to vote, even in terms of the whole hoax that voting is,
right,
by the time you get to vote, they have already decided pretty much who it's going to be. And even right. if it's like, even if there, and there is some element of Bush versus Kerry and all this stuff that's yeah. going on, and the Bush versus Gore and the, mm-hmm. the need to, the, for the first time, in the, well, actually not the first time, because they had that compromise way back after the Civil War that sold out Reconstruction, but we forgot about that one, you know. But there's this whole point where they do actually have people running, but those two people, they're going to be represent the interests of the imperialists. And I think what right. you're saying is very important. Do we want these people to be the most powerful people on the face of the earth?
Right.
Well, no, we don't. But there's actually bigger questions posed here, because even going in here, I think the biggest thing for them is ideologically what's concentrated in voting. Because when you go in and pull that lever, mm-hmm. it's not so much who you're choosing, but it's actually that you're choosing the system and the parameters for change
right.
to keep you within the system.
Exactly.
And that's a very important thing.
Right. And that just speaks to what I said earlier, too, about like you do not succumb to listing your demands, you know, for that very reason. What you should be doing is you should stay angry. You can try to figure out how to make that artful and so forth, because that'll help perpetuate the momentum forward, because it's very hard to maintain that real rage without letting it fly off the tracks. So if you can find art and you can find an artistic way to sort of like justify the rage and make it interesting to people, then you have forward momentum. Let the establishment come to you and beg for what they can do to make you happy.
You know, one of the things I've always been very careful about in relation to this movement is not trying to, and over the years too, not trying to put the weight of the past on the current situation, you know, in terms of the right. 60s. And it's one thing to look to the 60s for, you know, inspiration or to learn some things, but it's also, this is a different time, this is right. a different generation, facing, frankly, very different contradictions. And a much more right. serious situation in terms of the fate of the planet is directly at stake here. And so one of the things I'm really intrigued about is the fact that, one, this started very quickly. It didn't go from picket lines against the war, getting boiling oil thrown on you by the frats at college or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It actually started a call from Adbusters, and then all of a sudden people are out there.
Right.
And they're questioning the entire fabric of society,
right,
which I thought was very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with real progressives and real radicals. I think that the more the common person understands that being politically active or viable politically is, it's not figuring out what to say, it's figuring out what questions to ask. All you need to do is allow people the sense of bravery in asking a question. I mean, that's really what it's about, because people can really learn to shut up if they feel like they're stupid. So if you're saying, you know, you want to be political, well, what's your agenda? It's terrifying to most people, you know, it's terrifying. So they won't say anything and they won't get involved. Turn it around and just say, well, what's your agenda? And give it to me point by point. And then you can apply logic and just be like, you're illogical there. You know, just keep it to these points where you can help unravel somebody's, you know, screw ups.
You know, it reminds me of this point, the point of the importance of always demanding why. When somebody tells you to do something, you need to say why, no matter who it is. You ask why.
Right.
You know, and that's very important. And frankly, only those who have an interest opposed to the people would actually be terrified by that question. People who are about the emancipation of humanity would welcome that question and really dig into it, because that's exactly what you said. You know, one of the problems with this, the most powerful person on the planet, is it is the most powerful person. I don't care who it is, as you're saying.
Right.
Except for my Rottweiler, who is actually, he's running in the next election. So, but I think it's very important to actually understand that and to keep pushing that out to people that, but this is a movement that is standing up and they're saying, the world is not only intolerable, we aren't going to accept it any longer.
Right. And that's, again, another way to put it is that, you know, the greatest threat to the world, I've always thought, it's not the bullies. It's the people who don't question the bullies or are too well-mannered to fight the bullies or just say anything in deference to what they believe in.
We're talking with Dwayne Booth, or Mr. Fish, and the author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. And it's a really fabulous book. I've gone over it many, many times and shown it to many, many people, including all of the inappropriate, sometimes the inappropriate cartoons to show to my mother, for instance. She's currently recovering from a heart attack.
Perfect.
And I want to welcome you back, man, and we will have you back again very soon. Any closing comments as we go out?
No, onward, you know, just keep it up. We're onto something, I think.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dwayne. Great having you back, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, that about wraps our show up for today. I want to thank all of my guests today, Raymond Latta, Larry Everest, and Dwayne Booth, Mr. Fish. I want to thank my engineer for today, Cody James, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with something you'll probably hear me play time and time again because I like it so much. It's Iris DeMent with Wasteland of the Free.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. Growing increasingly unkind, and they say they are Christ's disciples. They don't look like Jesus to me. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got politicians running races on corporate cash.